You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius. It might be me, Everlast, and Guru wilding out at the strip club with me, X, and Everlast. That was just the click. Like, we're just all running around the streets. You know, we were wild young dudes back then, all carrying guns and all kinds of shit.
From the streets of Brooklyn, it's Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, the show that brings you exclusive conversations with hip-hop's most fascinating figures. This week, we're continuing a new feature on Outside the Lines, annotated interview excerpts. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to Rap Genius and search for Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. The very first result will bring you to the Outside the Lines artist page that will contain excerpts from our interviews with additional audio, video, and information to bring you further outside the lines. This week, we have a conversation with legendary A&R man, producer, and all-around Renaissance dude Dante Ross. His work at labels like Def Jam, Tommy Boy, and Elektra has been responsible for discovering some of hip-hop's best talent, like De La Soul, Busta Rhymes, MF Doom, and countless others. Far from resting on his laurels, though, Ross continues to manage and sign acts like Rock Marciano and Mayhem Loren, in addition to keeping a foot in streetwear, contemporary art, television, and just about everything else creative. We talked to him at our Rap Genius office in Brooklyn. So before we get really into it, I have to ask something. We have a very loyal listener to the show over in England.
Okay.
And he demanded that I ask you about Dope on Plastic.
Oh,
Who is this guy? Why'd he never release another record?
Uptown. Well, he was like a real street dude. He was related to Mace from Daylight. It's his cousin.
Oh.
He was like a wild dude from East New York. And we made that one record. And like, he kind of like disappeared. Like, he wasn't seen. And he was like a real street guy. I'll just leave it at that. I don't think that rapping was at the forefront of his daily needs. So he just kind of disappeared. And that record, I made that record on the SV-1200, and I made it in about... I didn't have a lot of records. I made it in the studio. And I had Kool & the Gang's Greatest Hits and a couple other records. I think like a P-Funk record, I had early Kool & the Gang Greatest Hits. I had a couple of 45s and I had a P-Funk album. And so I basically used every single record I had with me in my record bag, which was like all of six records. And that's what became Dope on Plastic. And that was it. And he did it really quick. My man CJ engineered it. And what's funny is to me that basically Eric B and Rakim fucking jacked the whole record a couple of years later, right?
Yeah.
They used all the same sounds, the same drum loop, chocolate buttermilk, the same horn squeal and everything. And I was like, wow. And it was weird to me that happened because I recorded at 1212 where Eric B used to record, where Paul C was from, where Large Pro always worked at. So it was bugged out that I did it in that spot. And, it's weird how that record has such a big effect. When I met the Booyah Tribe, that was they were like, yo, you made that record? Yo, that's our favorite record. Like, this was like a million years ago. And they like adopted me because of that. So that record is like, it's funny how like the cult following of that record. Rap Genius.
Yeah, how'd you find Uptown in the first place if he was so...
Maceo brought him to me. He was running around with De La.
Wow.
Yeah, so he was like going to be Maceo's artist, but it never worked out that way. Yeah, and I made that record like seriously... We had no idea what we were going to do. We got some time in 12 out in Queens. We stayed up all night and made it.
So that record shouts you out. You've obviously been shouted out a couple times on different records. Yeah. You know, you've been called some names here and there. Yeah. What's the best shout out you ever got on a song?
I don't know. Pooh Bah gave me one. I thought on 360, he was like, DR, are you with me? I was like that. I was I was always psyched on that. Everlast gave me a few shout outs. I think Bus gave me one. I don't really know. I got thanked on a lot of records. I know NWA thanked me on their first record.
Really? So, yeah. The NWA and the Posse?
Yeah, on the liner notes. I always thought that was cool.
How did that happen?
I met them. I met Dre and Cube when I was with Latifah in L.A., I think, at Skateland. Mm-hmm. It was two clubs, Skateland and World on Wheels. One was a Crip Club, one was a Blood Club. And we met Dre and them, and I became friends with Ice Cube. And that's how I ended up later on signing Del the Funky Homo Sapien.
Who's his cousin?
Yeah, and they used to call me up on the phone and bug out. And they came to New York and played the Apollo for the Urban Teen Awards. And I was like one of the only guys they knew in New York, and I was hanging out with them.
Wow.
Yeah.
NWA.
I might have been, me and this guy Funkin' Klein might have been the first fans they had in New York. And I liked them because I've always, I have a lot of family in California, so I've always gone back and forth a lot since I was a kid. Since I was a teenager. So because of that, I was like in LA and like I turned on the radio and heard Dope Man. I was like, what the hell is this? So I was like, I liked him from the first minute I heard him.
You were mentioning, discovering NWA, being early to them. When you were at Def Jam, when you started out, I assume you and definitely other people in Def Jam heard Nas's demo.
I hadn't heard Nas's demo there, and I never heard Nas's demo. By the time he got signed to Def Jam, I was already working at Elektra. And in all honesty, no disrespect to Nas, but the dude that a lot of people from Live at the Barbecue were really feeling, and he got a deal first because he had a demo, and he was around a lot and had a big personality, was Akinelli. Like, Nas was the shining star. But Akinelli was like, he had a big personality, and that's why he got a deal first. He got signed to Interscope.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I never heard Nas's demo.
Oh, wow.
I wish. I love him.
Yeah, yeah. What were those Def Jam days like? What was your relationship with Lior at that point?
It was good. Lior, he discovered me. He discovered me. How crazy is that? I don't know, man. I was friends with the Beastie Boys from high school. From even junior high school, we were all into punk rock, and we kind of all got into hip hop together as kids. And they were my peers, my contemporaries. And I was around them when they started getting famous. I was working in a restaurant. I was a waiter, and they used to come to my restaurant and get drunk all the time. We'd bug out, and they brought Lior in one day, and he was like, "What are you doing working over here?" I was like, "I don't know, man, but I got to figure out something because I don't want to be an actor." And he was like. I got in a lot of trouble with the law at that point, so I couldn't leave state. BC's were going on tour, they wanted to take me, but I couldn't go. So they took Ricky because I couldn't leave the state.
This is Ricky Powell.
Ricky Powell, my childhood friend too. I know him since I was 12 years old. And Ricky worked at Def Jam, he was office messenger. And Lior was like, "Yo, you want a job?" And I quit my restaurant job where I made $1,000 a week to make $225 a week working for Lior. And but I figured I'd get a career out of it, and I did. Yeah, and I always say that I did an interview with someone, and I said, "So what are your career highlights?" I said, "Winning a Grammy for Santana and fetching Lior lunch every day at age 20.
Wow. The Beasties, just because you knew them pre-fame, I was curious about, like, what was it like for them becoming so big so quickly? It was like,
I mean,
New York.
It was bugged out. Like, and in all honesty, when it happened, I was around them, but then when it got mega, because they had all these new...
You don't see people when they hit that.
Well, I would see them, but they had all these hanger-on people around them. I just didn't really want to be around all them dudes. Mm-hmm. Like, and also, like, I was, like, happy for them. God bless, love them, love Mike, Adam, and Adam. They're great guys. But it was, like, too much almost for me at that point. And that's when I was really into going to Latin Quarters, and I was going to find my own Beastie Boys. And that's what I was inspired by them. And still totally friends with them, but I just wanted to do my own thing. I didn't want to ride their coattails. So I just consciously separated myself from them a bit.
Okay. And at a certain point, you went from you know, errands and messaging at Def Jam to road managing, right?
Well, yeah, I did that too. I road managed Eric B and Rakim because I had a brain, and I went on one of the Beastie Tours, and their road manager, Sean, the captain who died, Sean Karasoff, who signed Tribe Called Quest, was like my big bro. He took me under his wing, and then we came back off the road, and he told Leo I could road manage. I knew what I was doing. So I started road managing people. And that's how I ended up kind of like ascending a bit. Because being a road manager, I was on tour, and I got to meet everyone. And like being a white guy other than the Beastie Boys, like was pretty exotic back then. So, and people used to like, oh, that's Leo's little man. So, you know, I got to know everyone in the whole world. Between the Latin Quarters and going on tour, I met everyone at the everyone who was a creative force in rap in New York at that point in time.
Wow. And, you know, eventually ended up at Elektra.
Yep. So before I went to Elektra, though, I went to Tommy Boy.
Oh, right, of course.
And I also...
Do you remember Prince Rakim from then?
Nah, he was after
me. He was after you.
But when I worked at Def Jam, and Sam Sever gets a lot of credit for this too, and I think I don't get the credit I deserved. I helped make Third Base a band. I was working with Pete, and I knew Search, and I put them together, and they became a band. And, like, I kind of wanted them to be the new Beastie Boys, but, you know, they were their own thing. But that was, like, my thing. And if I had more business acumen then, I would have signed them to myself and or been much more involved. Where, like, nowadays you can do A&R here and A&R a record here. And I didn't understand that I could still be their A&R guy, even though I worked at another label. And I didn't do that, and I probably should have.
Okay. How involved were you in the first couple?
Absolutely. I Sam Sever and Prince Paul produced it. Those are my two guys. Yeah. And I produced the second one. You know, me, Paul, and Sam. So I would say deeply involved and always around them.
What another person you discovered very early on was Busta, right, with his group. I've read stuff you've said about him, and you said even before he went solo, even in his group days, there was always something special.
Oh, yeah, he's shining.
If you had to put it into words, what was it about him that was special?
Well, one, he's larger than life. He's super charming. He's incredibly talented, great rapper, unique, has a real, like, yard man kind of, like, energy to him. Like, you feel the Jamaican thing. Very Brooklyn. He always had a huge personality, and he was very, very smart, very driven. And to this day, I say he's the most driven artist I've ever seen in my entire career. I've never seen someone who wants it and works as hard as him. And every album, Busta, people don't know, he does like 35 songs for every album. And like maybe only 15 make that album. But the catalog of work he has and just all the stuff he could do and how perceptive he was. And I say that because when we made the second record, they turned it in. I didn't like the second record. And I was like, this record's not good enough. And I played it for Lior and Chris Lighty, who was their manager at the time, who I love to death. He was one of my favorite people ever. We all determined it wasn't so good. And they were a band that was trajectory was going up, but it's a lot of infighting in the group. So Scenario was their biggest record. So I grabbed Q-Tip and I said, yo, Tip, would you want to executive produce the record with me? You'll oversee the production, you'll do a lot of it, you'll fix it, they listen to you, you could really like make this your thing, and I'll cut you in for a piece of it. And he was like, I'm down. None of the leaders wanted to do it. None of them except Busta. And they all shot it down for ego-driven reasons, led by Charlie Brown, and Busta took him aside. He was like, yo, I'm down to do that. And that's when I really, really knew that he was more perceptive than they were. He was a guy that everyone, when he performed in the band, when he got on the mic, that's when everyone got crazy. And it was very apparent. And I remember watching with Muggs. Me and Muggs was watching them, and they performed this place called The Building. And when Buster hit the mic, everyone went crazy. And Muggs turned to me and said, yo, he got to do his own record. And I was like, you're right. And the other thing was, they had a routine, jump, 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 jump. That became Jump Around. I mean, they took it from a Ninja Man song, Jump Around, Spread Out. But that's where they got it. But it's old reggae thing. It's old dance hall kind of routine. But that's really where Muggs was inspired to do Jump Around from. And he'll tell you that. Like, so, you know, and he saw that too. He's like, how come that's not a record? And I always would think to myself, Muggs is a great A&R guy because I saw him make Cypress and he saw that about them. He was one of the people I always listened to, always took his opinion highly. And, like, he was one of the people who said that Busta should be a star from Jump. I felt it, and Chris Lighty felt it. And me and Chris pulled him to the side. I'm like, Literally, we wanted to throw that second album in the garbage. I wanted him to go solo then, and we couldn't get him to do it. But after the record ran its course, he was like, I'm ready.
Rap Genius.
Back to you a little more. I know. I noticed looking at your credits, you're credited with playing instruments on a bunch of different records.
Yeah, I play keyboards.
Percussion, keyboards.
I play keyboards. Anytime I play bass, it's bass on a keyboard.
Oh, okay.
So it's not really bass.
Okay. Did you play in bands growing up?
I didn't really play in bands, but I could always play a little piano and a little guitar. Okay. So, you know, I took guitar lessons and I learned to play piano by ear, and then someone showed me basic chords. So, from that I could learn to play and also just making hip hop records. I always fiddle around with stuff and I could always figure out melodies. I could figure out melodies on a keyboard, a piano or organ since I was a little kid.
Okay.
Like if I could hear it in my head or hum it, I could usually figure out the notes for it.
Okay. Moving on a little bit. When you first started at Elektra, it seemed like you were kind of maybe the only person as an A&R at that time who was coming from inside hip hop rather than being dropped in from like the record company.
Yeah, that's what Dan Charnas says. Yeah. Dan Charnas says I'm the first major label A&R guy.
Yeah.
So maybe, I mean...
And what was it like over there when you were first kind of assembling the what would become your roster over there?
Well, it was weird because all these people didn't understand me. But I had this boss, Bob Krasnow, and he's like a legendary guy. He signed like George Clinton, Richard Pryor, Anita Baker, Patrice Rushen. He goes on and on. He had great love for black music, and he understood all music, but he was really loved black music. And I had done the De La record, and Latifah was bubbling, and people were trying to give me jobs. And I went to meet him, and I had a four-finger ring on. And he tried on, he said, can I see your ring? And he loved my ring. And he was like, and he had this big, nice diamond. Like, my ring was like $500. His ring was like $25,000 more. And I was like, let me see your ring. I was like, no, that's that shit. Like, and he had his ring on. He was like, yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm going to keep mine. And I just thought he was so cool. And he told me that he saw a lot of himself in me. He was a blue-collar guy from Cleveland. He had been a road manager. And I got offered a couple of jobs. And that's the job I picked to take because I liked him the most. And he was a white guy who worked on a lot of black music. So I had all these people around me who didn't understand me, like people who worked in the urban music department, but I had a champion, and he was the head of the company, so I was kind of untouchable.
Yeah. Well,
but it was a weird job, though, at first. It took me a year to get my feet straight.
I bet. And you worked a lot with, you keep saying Latifah, and you worked a lot with Flavor Unit in the
OK's. Well, I only worked with Latifah, but I remained friends with Shakim forever, and... I don't know if I worked, I guess I worked with 45 King. Yeah, I worked with the original Flavor Unit.
Right.
So that was like 45 King, of course. And I met him because he came up to me in Latin Quarters and he put a Walkman on me. He said, yo, you're Dante Ross? And I said, yeah, I don't know how he knew who I was. There was no internet back then.
No pictures.
He gave me headphones and he had like real studio headphones on his Walkman. And he played me a bunch of crazy music. And I was like, this guy's a genius. He called me on Monday with Fat Five Freddy. I started playing me music over the phone. One of the things they played me was Latifah. I told him to come meet me. He came 2 days later. And he came with Latee, Apache, Latifah, Lakim Shabazz, 45 King. And they played me mad music. Then we went down this block to the schoolyard to this place I used to play ball on 91st Street. And we smoked weed and played ball. And I knew Latee already. I already knew him because he knew some friends of mine. I was bugged out. So I already knew him, but I didn't know he rapped. Oh, and my friend Tahid was with him. He used to, Lord Alabaski, he was with him too. And that was the Flavor Unit. And that's how I knew him. I used to go out to Mark's house in Jersey, take the bus out there, and just bug out. And yeah, 45 King, he was my man when I was young. One of the first people I really bonded with who was like, to me, so what these guys didn't know is like, they were famous to me. Like they were on red, they were hot, they were on Red Alert show.
And now they're coming to you for work.
Yeah, they were like, they were larger than, they were, you know, yeah, otherworldly to me.
Yeah.
So I was always trying to play it cool. I didn't realize that they were usually just guys my age making music. And it was like bugged out. Like it was like when I first met Chuck D, I had their demo before it came out. I would always listen to it. I had it, the album before it came out.
The first one?
Yeah, because Flavor was in jail. I was waiting for him to come out. So he delayed the album a couple of months. And so we used to listen to it, me and the Beasties. That's when I was really into skating. It was real aggressive. I'd always skate to that. It was my shit. I'd like, we'd just play Public Enemy demo, me and my skater friends, and love it. That and what people don't realize is Public Enemy already had this cult of skateboarders that loved them. Like, they already had those, like, formerly punk rock white boys loving them. And largely because the Beastie Boys would play that tape for all their friends. It was like the record we all looked up to. So I met Chuck D. I thought he was going to be 6'6". And when he was 5'7" or 5'8", I was like, "You're not Chuck D." He was like, "Yes, I am." I was like, "Oh, yeah, with that voice, you are Chuck D." And I just told him how much I knew all his music. And me and Chuck started a friendship back then. It was real cool. But I couldn't believe that Chuck D was a regular guy.
Right.
Like, to me, he was like a mythical figure.
Rap genius.
And a lot of the rap guys were, too. You know, I sang with Jam Master Jay a little something, play ball with him. And I couldn't believe Jay was only 2 years older than me, a year older than me.
Yeah.
And he was like this, you know, he was a mythical figure to me. He was like taking me to eat Chinese food, you know, and like I was like, I'm hanging out with Jam Master Jay.
Right.
Well, what is going on in my life?
Did you know them I know you worked with them around like 99. Did you know them during your first?
Yeah, I knew Jay, Run, D. I knew them, Eric, their road manager.
Yeah.
I knew them from the Beastie Boy days. I was on tour with them when I was a little kid. I used to play ball with Jay when I was 18, 19 years old. Yeah, I knew them all. They're like, yeah, Jay was a great dude. All those guys, man. They were like, but like Run DMC was like, they were like rap superheroes to me. Next thing you know, I'm like eating Peking duck with these dudes. It's like really weird, man.
I believe it.
You know, rap music, you could touch it back then. You can't touch it nowadays.
Right. You know, speaking of different performers that you've known over the years, you've seen, and I wanted to ask you about this because you've seen like some of the biggest transformations in hip hop. You saw Zev Love X turn into MF Doom. To a lesser extent, I know he came to Tommy Boy after you left, but you saw Prince Rakim turn into RZA. And I was wondering about that, like what it was like to see these people you knew and one guy's so completely transformed to the point where like the only people who know what they were before are really hardcore fans.
I think it's great. You know, I mean, a lot of people start young in the game, so you're allowed to evolve. I mean, it's just like regular music. The Beatles were, you know, they started off, you know, being a pop band, like, you know, wearing suits and shit. Then it became like the psychedelic, like, dudes who changed the world. So, like, you know, if they're allowed to do that, why can't rap people do that, you know? I mean, and Doom was like, he was, so I knew Doom when he was really young. And Sub Rock, they were little kids. And he was a prodigy. You know, he was a child prodigy. He, at 17, he really produced Gasface. People don't know that. At 17, 18 years old, he was producing records for people. And Gasface, he did the drums on it, the whole shit. And no one knows that. So he was a prodigy, and so was Sub Rock. So, of course, you're going to see them grow and evolve and change. And because of circumstance, tragedy, as much as anything, he reinvented himself. And I feel like his reinvention was like, it has a lot of symbolic messaging to me. I mean, it's kind of like, I know it sounds like corny and shit, but it's kind of like the strength of Black America, like when I think about him. Because, like, you know, you could throw black people a handful of shit all day long, but they're going to go make the greatest thing in the world with that handful of shit. You know, you could fucking X, Y, and Z, and motherfuckers are going to take that X, Y, and Z and make it something beautiful and incredible. So he got, his brother died, he got dropped from his label, and he turned around and became a bigger, more important artist on his own, in his own way, you know, following his own path by his own means. And to me, that's like, he's a metaphor for the power of black people, like his career. And I think it's like, he's an amazing, remarkable person. I haven't seen him in a long time, but I love him. He's like my brother. He's like my little bro. Him and Sub, you know, they fucking stay at my house for weeks at end. And, you know, we'd fucking share a slice of pizza down the middle. Like, I love those guys. And watching him transform, because I knew him so well, and I saw how incredibly talented and artistic and creative and knowledgeable he was, does not surprise me at all. What people don't know is he's a great artist. He drew all that KMD shit too. Him and his brother both could draw anything, and they, you know, he's reading Bukowski at age 19. What rapper's reading that shit at 19? Like, he would come to my house, and just him and Dell would like be in my house and just make crazy music. And he's just like, that guy is super talented. He's a natural. He's just an extraordinary person.
Rap genius.
And RZA, who I didn't really know except in passing, when he came to my office, this is the greatest. He came to my office with Dirty when I went to sign Dirty. And he was like, "Yo, you remember me? I know you from the God Mel Kwan. You knew me when I was whack." And And I was like, we love you, Rakim. He's like, word. Yo, you know Mel Kwan, that's your man, right? I was like, yeah, Mel Kwan, the God, that's my man. Because that was his man, Mel Kwan. They said in the song, peace to the God, Mel Kwan. So that was my man. That's, you know, Just Ice lyric. But I used to hang out with Mel Kwan back in the day with King Sun and all these guys at the Latin Quarters and bug out with him and his man Shabazz. And so I already had the in with them. So Riz is another one. I think about RZA and Doom too, but RZA, like, so you're allowed to dream, right? You can manifest your dreams. Where RZA manifests his dreams more than anyone, probably other than Will Smith in history of hip hop. The guy directed a major motion picture. This is the RZA. The guy used to smoke dust in Staten Island inventing Wu-Tang Clan. I mean, just think about all that shit he's done. So to see him evolve and Zev evolve is like, it's not really so surprising. It's like a testament to artistry and creativity being allowed to breathe. And also, like, kind of like, you know, the natural evolution of an artist. So to me, it's like, you know, it's pretty common. Like, look at all these rock bands who, like, look at what the Who did, how they started out and what they became, or, you know, a million other artists.
Right. So I have to ask something in that answer. You talked about Mel Kwan and Shabazz, and they're shouted out on a million zillion records, and I never was quite exactly sure who they were.
Okay, so Mel Kwan was this big dude from the Bronx. He was mad tall, but then he moved to Staten Island. He was like the God Mel Kwan. He was like a 5%er. He was super smart. I think he became a screenwriter, if I'm not mistaken. He was a dude who was always around things. And, like, he was a real tastemaker. Like, he was in the middle of it all. He was a street cat, and his brother was, his man was Shabazz, and he had this company, Shabazz Brothers. And they were, like, one of the first, like, urban clothing companies. And I think Shabazz makes furs now. I'm pretty sure he makes furs and works in he's a garmento now. I don't know where Mel Kwan is, but those guys were like, they were like street cats. Somehow they knew everybody. And they took a liking to me when I was a kid. I was just always real cool with them. Like, I don't know what the hell it is, but I always got along with the 5%ers. I mean, the gods were always mad cool. And they were just two god body dudes. And Mel Kwan seemed to know the whole. Well, Mel Kwan put out a record too that was a big record, Sir I Boo. What's that record? The one that had Substitution, and they cut it and they didn't loop it. Holy Wars, that was on his label, Funky President Records. That was him, Mel Kwan, the God Mel Kwan. And I knew Sir I Boo because I played ball with his brother Kindu in Brooklyn. I used to play in the summer league with him, so I knew Sir I Boo. I think that's how I knew Mel Kwan, from Sir I Boo. And Sir I Boo was Kane's man. So somehow it's all connected.
Yeah, yeah. One of some of the most prominent 5%ers you've worked with, obviously, a Brand Nubian.
Of course.
Yeah. How'd you hook up with them?
I knew Pooh Bah from the Latin Quarters.
Oh, really? Just from club going?
When he was in Masters of Ceremony. Mm-hmm. I was friends with Positive K and K, Positive K. And, well, I was friends with Light, Audio 2, Nate Robinson. Then I met Positive K. Me and Positive K were wild guys back then. I used to drink a lot, smoke a lot of weed. We'd go to Latin Quarters. I would take them to the downtown clubs. I always knew a lot of women. Always knew a lot of girls. I was a dashing young man.
A model for a while, right?
Yeah, I don't like that. All that shit. I did that shit. Yeah. I was like the white guy in the urban modeling thing or whatever. Some dumb shit. People always just put me in photo shoots. So we'd always run around and shit and he brought Max out with us, and I'd click with Max. Those dudes both got great senses of humor. And we just fucking laugh, get drunk and laugh and bug out. They'd take me to the Quarters or whatever, and then we'd run down to, like, the World or whatever downtown spot, and I could get everyone in. I knew everybody. So that's how we all became friends. And I wanted Pooh Bah to produce Latifah because I thought that song Redder Posse, the reggae joint they had on, Mass Ceremony shit was great. I liked all their shit. I thought Pooh Bah was a genius. And me and Daylight used to listen to Mass Ceremony just to Pooh Bah's parts. We had the tape, we just fast forward to Pooh Bah. Listen how nice he is. Yo, he's so nice. We used to love Pooh Bah. So then when I started, I kept trying to get him to produce Latifah. He would always miss the appointments, always miss everything. But he came to me with the Brand Nubian demo. Demo was one song. Not going out like that, which Cypress Hill used the hook for later on. Ain't going out like
second
that.
Album. Yeah, yeah.
And it's very similar. And I don't know if it was conscious or unconscious, but they all had that song. And it was James Brown loop. And I never made the album, but he had that demo. And I was like, people started trying to give me jobs. I told Pooh Bah, yo, fall back. I'm going to take this job over here. I was either going to go to Capitol or Elektra. when I take the job, you're the first group I saw. I remember Monica Lynch was like, I know you're meeting with Grand Poobah, and you're meeting with him while you still work at Tommy Boy. I know you're talking to people about a job. I don't think it's ethical that you are talking about signing him somewhere else. I know what's going on. I was like, hey, it is what it is. I left my job, love Monica Lynch, but business is business. And then I signed Brand Nubian. And, you know, that's when Poobah became more militant black man, you know, 5%er. But I already knew a bunch of 5%ers from high school. And I don't know, man, race and all that shit never, I transcend most of that shit. That shit never really has been an issue with anyone ever with me, which is weird. Like, for all the, like, I never really had a problem with that. Also, like, one thing about when I worked with a lot of bands, I was, like, probably as street as those guys. You know, I'm like a blue-collar guy from Lower East Side. Like, I'm not like, you know, I'll go anywhere, do anything. Like, a pretty fearless kid. I think they saw that. And I think that, like, in New York City, most black cats, they know a white guy like that. That crazy one white guy grew up on the block with all the black guys. Well, I'm kind of that guy in real life. So I guess those guys all like me, man. I just always had a very close relationship with the Brand Nubians. Like, above and beyond my relationships with most other groups. I had a great affinity for them, and me and Poobah have a long history and a long friendship that's been tested and tried many times. But
I've read some stuff you've said about him that I imagine he was less than
about. You know, he's the greatest underachiever I know, one of the most talented people I've ever met, but he never puts it all together. I think he's scared of success. I think he was scared of success. You got to be accountable when you're successful. And I love the guy, though. And X and J, too. Those guys are great guys. And I'm glad to say 20-some years later, every time I see him, it's all love. We speak on the phone. Whatever it is, there's all a deep bond there.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about something Sadat said. I had him here a couple weeks ago.
I love Sadat X, by the way. He's one of my favorite people.
He was talking about the decline in... for lack of a better word, I hate the word, I'm sure you hate the word, but conscious rap, whatever, you know, stuff in that kind of vein. He's talking about the decline of it, and he attributed it to the powers that be being scared of it. Those are more or less his exact words. And I know lots of artists have said stuff like that over time. It seems a little bit far-fetched to me to think that it was like as conscious as that seems to imply.
Yeah, I don't know if it was.
You were pretty close to a lot of that stuff.
I feel like it's just monetization. Like, I feel like people don't like to think. We're in a disposable society, and people don't want to be challenged. And I think that a lot of, like, stuff with political agendas challenges people. And I think that, you know, we have a very vapid society, and it's just reflective of society. I think people were more inclined to hear that stuff back then. And if lack for a better word, it was almost a trend started by Public Enemy. And what's ironic is that NWA had something to do with that, but then they took it to a really nihilistic place, and that nihilistic place is where it ended up. You know, it goes beyond that. I have deep theories about it. I don't think necessarily the powers that be are the reason why. I think it's a public consciousness or lack of consciousness is the reason why. But for me, I always thought that stuff is thought-provoking. And my parents were liberal hippies. And for me, I grew up around a lot of, like, political activism. So for me, that stuff's always attractive to me. And always, like, it's inspiring and interesting. And honestly, I like it. I think it's thought-provoking. I like it when people stick it to the man. I like when people have dialogue about shit like that. I like it when people get scared. Like, I think that shit's cool. Like, fuck, scare a motherfucker. Good. I don't think enough people get scared nowadays, you know? And music isn't, it's not scary like that a lot of times. You know, it's vapid. But, so there's this other side of it where ignorance is, like, revered. Like, I think about Gucci Mane and all the hipsters who love him, how it's revered. And that's, like, could be deemed dangerous, but instead it's, like, comical. And that's, like, the inverse. That's the 180 it took from some form of consciousness to where it is now. I think that Nas attempts to be conscious at times. I think in a roundabout way, Jay is conscious because he's conscious with financial empowerment, you know, from within the system. But I do think for a large part of it is it's done. Also, people got comfortable and economics are really bad right now, so maybe people won't be so comfortable. We forget that in the late 80s, early 90s, we were in a terrible recession. And I think that that's why a lot of that anger came from the music. You know, and I think that, that hip-hop is always directly tied to whatever's going on economically in the country. And we forget that sometimes. It's reflective. Like how NWA talked about all that shit, and we had the Rodney King riots and all that. I mean, that's like foretold it all, and Public Enemy as well. So maybe we'll get some more of that. I think Kendrick touches on it. He's a conscious cat, and he touches on a lot of crazy shit. So it remains to be seen. I do think it stopped being profitable. And when things stop being profitable, you know, people aren't going to deal with it anymore. I mean, look at the decline in lyricism or even pure rapping ability. Like, the greatest rappers now are the guys who were the greatest rappers 10 to 15 years ago. Eminem, Nas, and Jay-Z. They're still the best rappers. Maybe you put Kendrick up in there now. But that's the only guy who's coming along in umpteenth years who can challenge that paradigm of rappers. And it says to me that the art form is kind of regressive sometimes, man.
You talked in that answer about people being scared, and one of the things that scared people a lot was the cover of the final KMD album. Do you remember that decision? Did you ever try to say, "Hey guys, maybe you shouldn't"?
Nah, hell no. I remember clearly. It's really one of, so it's like,
sorry for our listeners who don't know. Can you describe the cover?
Okay, so it was the album was called Black Bastards, and it was a play on the game Hangman. And it had a couple of the letters from Black Bastard, several of the letters, and it had Sambo, the KMD character, getting hung. So Sambo is getting hung, and it says, basically, and this isn't hard to figure out, death to stereotypes. We are not Sambo anymore. We are not Black Bastards. We're killing this. We're killing this ethos. And it scared the fucking shit out of people. But the irony is that KMD were little kids who weren't scared of anyone. They were like great intellectual little kids. Those guys, man, I was more dangerous than they were. So I mean, but they were like, you know, it was the first time that I had worked at a major label that I thought, this might not be something I'm going to do the rest of my life. And then I've thought that 50-100 times since. But I was like, this is the fucking biggest crock of shit I ever seen in my life. And my boss called me, and I remember, and he was like, you know, I got to talk about this album. We can't put this out. I was like, what do you mean we can't put this out? He's like, look, this woman, Terry Rossi, she's the Billboard R&B reporter. She caught wind of the album cover, and she's going to go after us. And she did. She wrote a big thing about it, and she had rallied up several prominent black people in the industry to vilify the record. And they were, my boss at the time, Bob Krasner, was unempowered. And he told me that. He said, look, I'm fighting a lot of battles here. And I don't think I can fight this one. So we were supposed to have a meeting with the board of supervisors. I don't know what they're called, but the board at Warner Brothers, me and Zev and me and Doom and this was on the heels of his brother having been killed too. So he'd been through
a lot of emotional.
Yeah, well, also he'd been through a lot of emotional shit.
Yeah.
So maybe he especially didn't care, but I really cared because, you know, we had buried his brother. So we're supposed to meet the powers that be at Warner Brothers. I guess it was, what's the guy's name? Dick Charles. Richard Parsons, rather. I believe Sylvia Rome, but I could be wrong. Terry Rossi, a bunch of other people. And we're going to have dialogue about the record. Because I'd said to my boss, do you understand what this is saying? Killing stereotypes. There's not one thing racist about this. You got to let the kid defend his thing. And my boss, he believed in freedom of speech. And the day we showed up for the meeting, my boss was like, we're not going to have this meeting. We've decided we're going to let the band go. And he told Doom, he's like, I'm going to give you back your masters. I'm going to write you a check for X amount of money. And I'm going to let you go. And Doom really seemed unfazed by it. You know, went to my office and I had a case of wine that someone had sent me. And it was white wine, sweet premium wine. And that's the song. And he popped open a bottle, made him drink two bottles of wine. And he said to me, I should get dropped more often every day. He said, I'm going to get $25,000 on my record back. And I was absolutely crushed. And we walked downstairs out of the building drunk. And I walked to the train. He walked the train, and I walked to a cab, and I took a cab home. And that was it. And It was a decision that I've always thought was absolute crock of shit. Thought it was total bullshit. They weren't allowed to defend their rhetoric, their point of view, and I believe in dialogue, and there was no dialogue in this case. And the kid got thrown to the wolves. And as a testament as a human being, he took all of that shit he got handed and reinvented himself as MF Doom and basically invented, you know, underground backpack rap.
Rap genius.
Moving to something a little more mainstream that you're involved in, you've said that What It's Like was sort of the one record in your whole career where, like, how you felt about it and how a mass audience felt about it intersected. Why do you think it was that record? What do you think about that record connected with so many people?
Because that record, when you just play without any of the bells and whistles, that was a great song. And didn't need a lot of bells and whistles. I heard the song, and the song jumped out at me. And I grew up, like, listening to all kinds of music. My mom was really into, like, Van Morrison and Bob Dylan and a lot of singer-songwriter stuff. So when I heard it, it held the weight of those kind of artists to me. And I was like, wow, this is really incredible. And I was given the opportunity to frame the song the way I thought it should be framed. And I really, when I heard it, I'd never heard anything like it when we put it together. And not only had I never heard anything like it, but I had never heard anything like it that was tangible and accessible. And I knew that I had something. And everyone heard that song from A to Z always reacted. There was never anyone who didn't react. It was such a pure emotional song. And also a testament to Everlast talent, that I was not surprised when it became the hit record it became. I really, really believed in it from the minute I heard it. And I had to convince him to record it. He didn't even want to record it. So,
that's always the case. People don't recognize their,
he was scared. He was scared. He thought he could never rap again or have any relevance in rap. And I was like, who cares? I was like, who gives a flying shit? Like, that shit's corny anyway. And we did the record and had great success for it. And then, it's always nice to hit a home run with your friends. He's like one of my best friends in the world. So for me to be able to do that with him was really special. And it's funny, Sadat and Guru are the reasons I made that record with him.
Really?
Yeah, man. It's so. I knew Eric forever, and I always like Everlast, and he's me, him, and Muggs were cut of the same cloth. We're all like blue collar, scrappy white dudes, like, you know, no silver spoons in our mouths, and, you know, we're those kind of dudes. So
that made you get along and not
right,
dislike each other, like
right,
sometimes happens.
Right, right. Instead of white on white crime, as I call it, you know, yeah. I was like, oh, these guys, and the Soul Assassins in general, they adopted me early on. I was always super, super family with them kids. I always had lots of love for them, and vice versa. And so me and Everlast linked up, and we started making music together, and it was very natural from day one. I mean, he moved to New York and lived in my house for like 4 months, just like, well, I was going through all this crazy shit, and we made that record, and I don't know, it was always just, it was a wonderful thing to work with him. So the way Sadat and Guru hooked me up, I was in L.A. with Sadat on a solo tour when I was managing him for Wild Cowboys, and Guru showed up at the hotel with my friend Tammy, who Everlast used to, she was his assistant, Everlast used to bang her. Everlast came to meet her, and Guru was like, y'all motherfuckers need to work together. Y'all the same motherfucker. And we started laughing, hung out and got all drunk, whatever, whatever. And we was talking on the phone, and he hit me up like a couple weeks later. He said, yo, man, I want X to come out. I'm doing my third album. I want to see if he wants to come and rock, do this song with me. So I hit X up, said, they got money for you? Yeah, I'm going to go out there. So he went out there for like a week or so. And they became good friends. Like, they just bonded. And Sadat was always Everlast, one of his favorite MCs. So they became good friends. So whenever he would come to New York or we go to L.A., the first thing we do is hang out with Everlast. Yo, what's up? We always call up crazy-ass Everlast. So he would come and hang out with us or come to New York. And then I guess that was the bond. It started right there. Guru, though, and he had that song Fed Up with Everlast on the last album, too. And Guru, rest in peace, he was my man. He used to always fuck around with us, too. That might be the clique going out one night. It might be me, Everlast, and Guru wilding out of the strip club with me, X, and Everlast. That was just the clique. Like, we're just all running around the streets. You know, we were wild, wild young dudes back then, all carrying guns and all kinds of shit. And between them two dudes, that's how me and Eric got real close and ended up making that record.
Carrying guns around?
I mean, yeah, we used to all carry guns. Fuck yeah. I was part of, that was like how we lived back then. I always had a gun. So did Eric got arrested for it. I think Guru did too. So I think X did too. I think everyone except me has caught a gun charge. So, but that's another time in life. Sure. You know, you outgrow all that shit. Thank
Definitely.
God.
There was something that really surprised me that you said about a guy who we've actually had on the show before who was curious.
Oh, I love him.
You said that he was the best freestyle rhymer.
Him and Casual from Hieroglyphics, the two best I've ever seen. Yeah, they could just go on and on and on. For, I mean, Supernatural too, I guess. But I know Supernat like that. I know him, but not like that. And I've seen both of them just destroy dudes. I've seen Curious at the Gavin, him and Casual. Mantra's in it too, and they put on a show. They took everyone out, and it was every rapper of merit ever, from Drez to this one to that one to I believe dudes nameless. CL Smooth was in there. Then some Bay Area dudes, and them dudes was just doing circles around cats. And then Curious went to radio with all them dudes, and he got on KMEL and he destroyed everybody. He rapped off the top of that for so long and was so good and could rap about anything in front of him. He was such a natural and so loose that I think that actually, like they say, a lot of freestylers can't make records. I think that was maybe one of his problems. That didn't come as natural to him as freestyling. And he had only been rapping like a year. Like when he was that good. And Casual was like that too. Casual could just rap. He could just rap his ass off. Those two guys, you know, that's why they made that record What's the Real together, because they were like, they would always hang out together too. And you know, like Hieroglyphics and Curious were like this, and KMD, like, and Doom. That was all like, and they're all, I guess that was the common bond, but their relationships were their own relationships. They were all really, really good friends. And I was always good friends with them too, just a little older than those guys. I had more stuff going on in my life.
Sure. Crazy. And winding down, I think when I read you talking about making Dirty's album, and you said you knew from jump that it was just this timeless thing. And that's something.
Well, also it was a time sensitive thing too.
Yeah.
Because I felt like he had a self-destruct button on him.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, you know, it's like he was such a wild ass dude. You're like, you know, so erratic. He like, you know, you've seen it before. Like, fuck, I guess Jim Morrison was like that. And, you know, Dash Snow, right? You know, the dudes are going to, they might not make it to the end. Like, you know, they're just living so, so wild. And their life is their art is their life. And there's no separation. There's no boundaries. And he was that kind of guy. So, like, I saw that he, you know, Sid Vicious or who, you know, there's a million examples.
He wasn't playing crazy on
it. Nah, he was just a wild ass dude. And he got shot making a record. And he jumped through a window when he was making a record. And
whoa, jumped through a window.
Yeah, I think he was on Angel Dust, and I don't know. No one really knows. But he ran in someone's house in Queens. He said people were following him, and some dogs chased him upstairs, and he jumped out the window and got bit by dogs, and he broke his collarbone, I think. Yeah, and it was all this crazy shit. And so I felt it was time sensitive. I had to get to the finish line. Like, I was like, there may never be a snapshot of this again. And I'm committing my life right now to getting this done, because this is an important piece of art. And I've never been conscious of that before or since. Maybe because my parents were like pretty artistic and creative and kind of cosmic people. I had some consciousness of that. And I read a lot, and like, you know, he was almost like Baudelaire or some shit. It's like some crazy thing going on with Dirty. And I knew I had to get to the finish line. So I did whatever I could. I sacrificed a year of my life to get to that finish line, and it didn't really matter much else what was going on, because I had to get that done. Because I knew it was going to be a testament to his legacy forever, and something for me as well. There was a little selfishness, and I was like, I'm going to be associated with this record forever. Another thing is, I love the guy. He was a handful. I've worked with a bunch of crazy motherfuckers in my life. Big characters, big personalities. He's the biggest of all of them. The biggest ever, and when we worked together, there was nothing I wouldn't do for him.
What's when you think of him, what's the first like anecdote that comes to mind?
So many. He's the funniest motherfucker I've ever known in my life. I mean, the craziest one is, I told the story a lot of times, when he took the LL record off the wall and pissed on it. And my other good friend Chris Lighty, rest in peace, was involved in that too. And I was in between a Mexican standoff between Chris and his brother and Crazy Sam and Dirty. And how no one got shot is beyond belief. But he was going to do a record with LL, and LL didn't show up. and Dirty was offended. But LL wasn't going to show up. He was going to track it separately, and he was furious that LL wasn't there because he said LL doesn't want to meet a motherfucker. Like, fuck a LL. Oh, Dirty's not good enough to meet LL? You know, fucking motherfucker. And LL was probably like in LA, like, well, who knows where he was. But he wasn't there. No big deal. Dirty's getting a $10,000 check. And Dirty fucking lost it, and Chris came in, and Crazy Sam was there, and they had some problems, and they were beefing, and it almost became like a Mexican standoff, and fucking Dirty, I got Chris out of there by the grace of God, and Chris was going to shoot Crazy Sam, no lying, and Chris was not a joke. And Dirty took a LL Cool J record off the wall and pissed on that fucking thing. He pissed on the fucking record at Chongqing, pissed right on it. And I was like, you are the... I mean, he was going to get shot. It was the craziest thing of all time. And somehow I got it, went out of there.
Rap Genius.
There's a couple other ones, man. He performed on the corner of Hollywood and Vine after leaving the Palladium, where he just shut it down. No shirt on. Bottle of Cisco on a lamppost, climbing on it, hanging, performing while he's drinking Cisco with no microphone, with about 300 people around him. And the cops were going to come, and I had to get him down, and took him back to his hotel up the block to the Roosevelt, where he ate 12 donuts and started telling jokes. And there's a lot more.
I'm sure.
I'll save him for my book, though.
I'm sure. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I wanted to touch on something that's a little... off to the side a little bit. I know you're a big fan of Son House.
Oh, yeah. I love the blues in general. The blues is rap music.
How do you mean?
It tells stories. It's like the story of the people, you know? It's like it's real connected to, like, the people. There's not a lot of... It's what rap music should be. It's pure.
And you had a chance to kind of put that in a little bit in your work with Everlast.
Yeah. That was part of the beauty
of
it.
Country blues kind of thing.
Yeah. And I love that kind of stuff. I mean, I love music. So, you know, I'm like a big Albert King fan too. And like Son House is like, he's where it all comes from. Robert Johnson and Son House. You know, but I love Howling Wolf, Muddy Waters. I listen to all that all the time. You know, I mean, I love music, so.
That's one of the things that I found so odd about you is, like, so many people with your history and your base of knowledge would just kind of coast in a way, you know, just say, okay, well, I know everything up until, you know, 1987 or 1995 and stuff after that I don't really fuck with.
Right.
But you're constantly, you know, signing new artists, you know, even managing people, staying on top of what's current.
What I do, that's how I make a living. I mean, that's part of that. That's just, you know, survival tactics. But also, I'm inspired. Like, I'm always inspired by new things, whether it's visual art, literature, music, you know, and I'm always looking for some new inspiration. Life without inspiration is mundane. So, you know, I always want to be inspired. Like, when we talk about blues in relation to rap music, to say that, like, I hear that in Big Crit. Like, I hear Crit's music, I hear, and even some Outkast stuff. I hear, like, and Scarface, I hear a thread of that in there. I don't know if it's crossing from the South or what it is, but I hear some of that in there. And I think if your eyes are wide enough, you see the connections in everything. And I'm lucky enough to see that. So I am inspired by lots of new music. There's lots of stuff out there, whether it's rock music, whether it's like indie rock, electronic music, rap music. I just tend to always be inspired. Or visual art, I try to always find some inspiration. It's really easy for me to find things I don't like. It's much harder for me to find things I do like. So to find things I do like, I have to look a lot.
Yeah. And winding down, you once told an interviewer, you said, when people stop fucking with breaks, that's when rap music got corny.
I mean, you know, like, that's a big, broad, sweeping comment, right? Because I don't know if Outkast necessarily fuck with breaks or Big Crit or a lot of things I really like just the two things I just mentioned, or even ASAP Rocky and things like that. But there was an element in rap music when people were using breaks a lot that, you know, I guess it defines the boom bap era, that made music a lot more soulful. And that's probably why I liked Action Bronson so much, because he had that in there. And I think that, you know, using breaks, it's the era I come from. It just, the way things were recorded, the guys who were playing on stuff, it's way funkier and more soulful than trap music to me. So for me, like, when people stopped using breaks, rap got less soulful. So who's, like, some of the best stuff in rap music? Jay, Kanye, Just Blaze. Well, they still use breaks.
They can afford to.
And that's what, right. But those are why those records are great. Yeah. So.
Definitely. And so what do you have going on now? You got a million things, obviously, a hand in streetwear.
I consult for, I work for Supra. I've worked for a bunch of streetwear brands, so that's one of my side hustles. I work at Warner, signing bands. I manage a bunch of people, Rock Marcy, my man Scotty, this new band I work with, After the Smoke. Not producing so much anymore, but writing a lot, working on a couple of TV things with...
one of the Ego Trip guys.
Well, no, I did that. That didn't really work out. But I'm working with Drew Barrymore's company right now, Flower Films, with my friend Ember, and we're doing a couple of things. Working on a teen novel with my friend Amy Koppelman, who's a show at the Sarah Silverman Show. And I wrote my memoirs, and I'm finishing that up and looking at writing a whole lot more than I was in the past and continuing my job and hopefully continually be inspired. And I collect a lot of art, too. That's another thing I do. So, and I'm always, like, looking at some art or, like, some weird shit. Someone once told me that I was an intellectual thug, and I kind of like that. So I kind of keep it. That summed me up pretty good.
That was our conversation with Dante Ross. If you have comments or questions about Outside the Lines, you can hit me up on Twitter. I'm @SameOldSean. That's S-H-A-W-N. If you enjoy what you're hearing on Outside the Lines, visit us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so that you never miss an episode. You can also leave us a review. The more reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get quality guests like Dante Ross. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sotaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
What I do with Toss, that's how I make a living.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Me, him, and Muggs were cut of the same cloth. We're all like blue-collar, scrappy white dudes. Like,
the music is by Psionic.
We made that one record, and like he kind of like disappeared.
This interview was recorded by Sean Sotaro and Tommy Fisher.
It was a decision that I've always thought was absolute crock of shit.
Our show's intern is Sonny Kahara.
And he was a prodigy. You know, he was a child prodigy.
And the webmaster of the upcoming OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com is Paul Dice, who can rest easy now that his questions about Uptown's Dope on Plastic have been answered.
I think he was on Angel Dust, and I don't know. No one really knows. But he ran in someone's house in Queens. He said people were following him, and some dogs chased him upstairs, and he jumped out the window and got bit by dogs, and he broke his collarbone, I think.
We'll see you next week on Outside the Lines when we talk to author Adam Mansbach, whose novel Rage is Back follows an old-school graffiti artist as he returns to a changed New York City. His special guest will be DJ J Period. See you then.
It's like the longest interview.